Hi, everybody. My name is Nancy Morris, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi.
And thanks, Matt, for inviting me here. And thanks, all of you, for just being here and being enthusiastic members of Alcoholics Anonymous, because that makes me feel safe and secure, that I can go anywhere and find good meetings and people like you. I'm on my way moving to California as I speak. My clothes are in the car, some of my clothes, so this was kind of hard to get ready because I have dresses but not shoes for certain dresses and this and that, but you know, that things like that used to really bother me, and I would be out buying new things, but it's like, whatever, now it's okay. It's like, you're all thinking about yourselves way more than you're thinking about me, so it's okay. And the thing about speaking, too, I mean, I do get nervous, and when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, when I had to go up to a podium, I would shake, visibly shake, and people would sometimes get smelling salts out, and you know, but now I know I sit there and I turn it over. I ask God to give me the words. I say, I will stand up here and open my mouth. And then when I sit down and I immediately start criticizing something I said or something I didn't say, then I tell myself, just shut up. You're criticizing God. If you turned it over, you turned it over. So, and then also, you know, in the past, people, maybe somebody missed a meeting and they would ask me, who talked at the meeting? And this would be like less than 24 hours later, and I'd have to think really hard who talked at the meeting. So I know that happens when I talk, too. So I don't know, some woman from, I don't know, she had reddish hair and whatever. So I really like what it says in the program. I just want to read this really quickly because to me this sums it up for me. It says, life will take on new meaning, to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. And that's from the book. And that holds true for me. Wayne and I were talking about that because I am on my way out to California. I got sober in California. I was in that group for 16 years before I moved to Minnesota, where I lived for 10 years. But we have this group of people in Minnesota that they just mean an awful lot to me. And I went out to California last month to take our stuff, and it's very huge out there. The group we belong to is very huge, and it's kind of fragmented. And immediately, I was asking different friends of mine, where do you go to meetings now? Because it used to be we went to the same meeting every night. I knew where everybody was. But everybody's, well, I go to this one on Monday. I might go to this one. And I got really scared. You know, I've been sober a while, but it doesn't make any difference. I got very, very insecure when I was out there. And then my mind started saying, you know, You don't have to go to any meetings. Nobody would even know. And when I moved to Minnesota and I was 16 years sober, I was driving to Minnesota and I was thinking, you know, you've been active for 16 years. You've done all this stuff. You really don't have to do that much anymore. And that's just the way it is. That's why I think that Wayne used the word, he does things to protect himself. And that's what I need to do, too. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, and I love what goes on here, but the disease is still a part of me, and there's a lot that goes on in my head. And before I forget, I enjoyed hearing Wayne and Scott and Thelma, and I just thought all three of them just really articulated very well and just described who and what we are all about very well. I enjoyed hearing them a lot. And before I got up here, Wayne said, break a leg. And I think he meant it literally after, like, what he did last night. But a woman I sponsor is here with me. She may be in the room with her baby daughter because I told her if Molly was asleep, don't wake her up. I mean, you can't reason with a six-month-old baby who's tired. But sponsoring Lisa, she was the first woman I started sponsoring in Minnesota. And so I've seen her, you know, when she was new, and she's nothing like she is now. And I've seen her kissing all the toads before she married the guy, you know, he's not a toad, he's a prince. But I've been through a lot with her. She used to call me up, when she'd get mad, she'd really get mad, and I think her daughter Molly has the same thing. But I used to hand the phone to my husband sometimes, and I would say, Lisa's really mad, would you just like hold the phone for a while? And but it's just been such a privilege to... she's an illustration for me of what this is all about, to meet somebody like that and see how she dressed and her purple and blue hair and to watch her grow and change and get married and have this little baby. And my husband gave her away at the wedding because her father had died shortly before that. And she's a part of my life and she's in my heart. And then... poor Jessie over here, when I saw her yesterday, I just started laughing. She's grown a lot since I've met her, too. And I just think that's really neat. And see Jessie and Andy, and soon their life is going to change a lot. But I am on my way out to California. I went... my husband and I can't really say my husband and I because he hasn't even seen where he's going to live yet in California. He's on his way, and he's going to see it tomorrow. It's a houseboat, and it's 26 feet long, and it's 10 feet wide, but it's on the water, and we both like the water. We left a three-story house in Minnesota, so it was kind of hard to squeeze all that stuff that I've collected, and... onto this 26 by 10 foot houseboat. We didn't actually. I don't know what this is all about, but we left mostly everything in Minnesota. A guy that my husband sponsors bought the house from us, and two other alcoholics are going to live there with him. So we left a lot of the furniture there, and I left him a sign on the wall. The guy, somebody gave my husband this plaque as a going away gift, and it said, "A man's home is his castle until the queen arrives." And but the guy that bought our house is gay, so I left it on the wall for him. So it was just kind of neat to have those guys moving in on Monday night. And I went out to California I think it was in July, just this last July. Now, Ed and I have been talking about moving away from those winters up there for the last 2 years. We've talked about it. We've explored different ways to move, and nothing seemed to work out. And I was going out in July, and I told Ed, I said, you know, I've always had this idea to live on a houseboat. And he said, well, why don't you buy one then while you're out there? And then before I went out there, I called a friend of mine who's in Al-Anon, and she lives in Palm Springs or Palm Desert or whatever, and I called her about something completely unrelated, and then at the end of the conversation I said, oh, here's my latest crazy idea. I want to live on a houseboat. And she said, oh, Vinoy sponsors this woman who has two of them for sale. So it's like, okay, get me her phone number. And I went out there, and I got the phone number, and I was able to meet the lady who had the houseboat for sale the morning of the day I was going back to Minnesota. And I had talked to my sponsor a little bit before, and he said, well, why don't you just rent it at first? And I said, okay. And then I met the lady with the houseboat, and I made an offer, and she accepted it, and I wrote her a check. And I went to a payphone and called Ed and said, I bought a houseboat. So that's what we're doing. And it's just just one of those things that, you know, as long as I don't drink, it'll be okay. Ed weighs 260 pounds, and I don't weigh that much. And I made the houseboat move when I walked on it. So I told him, like, when I'm at one end of it, at the, you know, the 26th foot end of it, and he walks in, he won't even have to say he's home. I'll just come sliding down to him, probably. So, and then, like, just a month ago, we just got this big truck. I'd been packing all our stuff, and we loaded the big truck, and I took off by myself in the truck and drove it out there, and I ended up having to unload it by myself at nighttime when I got there, because I found out they're building a new seawall and you can't drive any vehicles back and where I needed to be. So after driving in from Utah, then I unloaded this houseboat, and so I got, you know, it was finally like 3:30 in the morning, and the boxes were piled to the ceiling, and I just like found a pile of blankets and laid down on the floor, and I just cried, and I'm like, what have I done? This is like one of the weirdest things you've ever done so far. But I ended up fixing it up really nice and putting all I have on the walls are some AA things, which and I did get a storage locker for the things I didn't leave in Minnesota, and it's just AA stuff, and it's stuff people have given us over the years that I couldn't part with, and I think it'll be fine, and going back to the group where I got sober, and I think it'll be just fine. It's really breaking my heart a lot to leave. We started some meetings up there, and we just have this wonderful network of friends, and I like the fellowship part of this. You know, we do go to the same meetings every night. We do go to coffee. We go for walks, and people are accessible, and I really like that, and that's real important to me, so I'm going to have to make sure that I have that in California. There was another time in my sobriety when I left California for 7 months. I was leaving a marriage, and the only way I could do that was leave in the middle of the night, and I sat down and I wrote about 60 notes to people, women I sponsored and friends and my sponsor, and it said, I have to leave, I'm having personal problems, I'm going to Hawaii, and I'm never coming back. And that's how I felt at the time, and I was 12 years sober. And you know, during the long goodbyes that we've been having in Minnesota, I thought, God, it's like almost easier just to leave, you know. But then I thought, no, it's really good that I care about these people and they care about me. And it's a good feeling. And I've maintained my relationships with my friends in California, and I'm sure that we'll do the same thing. We're already thinking now, in a year we'll buy a bigger houseboat, keep the little one that we have for all of our visitors that come to see us. So we have great plans. I am an alcoholic, and I too love Alcoholics Anonymous. I took to it right away. I've been active for 26 years, most of the time, and it is the most important thing in my life. And it doesn't keep me from having a life outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, but it does come first in my life. There's no doubt about that. I come from a family of, one more thing I just want to say, and Tanya and the other, you know, the women from Norfolk, I don't get that, it's N-O-R-F-O-L-K, but it's Norfolk, so okay, but Mickey and the other women, you know, I met them all at the Spring Classic, and they're friends of mine, you know, and that's just really neat. Mickey and I have emailed a few times, and she brought some women here, and they had a tailgate lunch today, a little party, and we just sat out there in the parking lot and ate lunch, and it was just so nice, and so it's great to see you all here. But I come from a family of, I have five brothers, one sister, a mother, and a father. My five brothers are alcoholics. I don't think any of them drink alcohol anymore, but the ones especially that still live in Hawaii smoke that pakalolo. That's what they call it there. And none of them really ever took to the program. A little, you know, they would start, and I think really the key is what it says on this program, and it's not what I can come to meetings and get. It was drilled into me from the beginning what I can give and put into a meeting, and you know, becoming involved in these people's lives. That's what's hooked me here, and I always think when people go away. The ones I know, anyway, it's pretty clear to me that they weren't doing that. I can, you know, they just would sit in the meeting and say, well, I hear the same thing over and over. If you're 6 months sober, you're going to hear the same thing over and over. That's it. There's just very basic care, and there's just different ways to say it, and maybe when we're telling experiences of what, you know, about our drinking, that may be different, but the recovery is very basic and it's very simple. But So I do see people leave, and I know they didn't give, and they didn't, they may have given a ride every now and then, but that's just not enough. And I know there have been times along the way I've said, I've done this over, I've had people live at my house, I've given rides, I sponsor people, but it's not working, and it's like, just keep doing it, okay? Just keep doing it. But I grew up in this family, and my father died of alcoholism when I was about 6 months sober. And actually, I could make a happy time out of it because I was the only one in my family that was sober, and I had the privilege of taking him to a few meetings before he died so he could find out that he had a disease and that it wasn't his fault that his seven or six children, my sister doesn't drink, she's just very strange and weird, and she should drink, and then she'd be okay. But it wasn't, it's not his fault that his family, drank. Most of the people in his family drank, his children. It wasn't his fault. I took him to some meetings, and that was just a gift. I was so lucky because other people in my family suffered a lot because he was gone. And then they're like, well, I should have done this, and I should have done that. And I didn't have that feeling at all. Thelma mentioned that when it was your sister's funeral, right? And I sponsor a woman in Minnesota whose father died last week, and she had plans to go away with another member of AA, and she had put a lot of money into this trip, and she needed the trip, and I strongly encouraged her to go on the trip. She was going to miss her father's funeral. Her mother's already gone, so she didn't need to go support her mother. And she was the only one, because of this program, out of six, that really paid attention to the father, even though she didn't really like him. Last Christmas, she had him come to Minnesota. She didn't really want to, but nobody else was going to have him, so she had him come. And she could just bring him to meetings and have us for dinner, and, she got through it. So that when he died, she had a clear conscience and a good feeling about it, and she did go away with the person that she said she was going to go away with. And she got dirty looks from her family. But you know what? It's like I had to learn to be true to myself. I lived my whole life trying to please everybody else, and then I'd go home and suffer for it. And I never wanted you to be mad at me, or I didn't want to hurt your feelings. And then I would go home and just be miserable because that's the way I was. But I started drinking as a young teenager, and probably like most of us, I didn't pick up a drink and say, I'm drinking this because I have no self-worth, I'm very insecure, I'm afraid of people, I don't know how to relate, so I'm going to take a drink and everything will be okay. It's just, I just started drinking when I was a young teenager. It was just a part of my life. My family drank. We had a built-in beer keg in the refrigerator. Extra refrigerator, and I would save up empty jars during the week, and when my father put the keg in, I would fill these jars with beer and put them in my closet and wait, and I would get as much as I could from the keg without anybody knowing, and then when the keg would be emptied, I would just go in my room and shut the door and drink my beer, and that's kind of just what I always did until I got here. I didn't know anything until I came here and got sober, and I didn't know anything like the first week either. I mean, I'm still learning things to this day. But I just simply drank, and I lived my life for your approval and for your attention. Sometimes this would be good, and sometimes it would be bad. It would depend on who I was with and what they wanted me to do. But I got pregnant when I was 15 years old just because a man dared me to sneak out of my house in the middle of the night. He was just a bum, and he lived up at this stable across the street from my house. He lived in this little shack up there. But he dared me to sneak out of my house in the middle of the night, and I had to do it. And I did it, and I got pregnant. And I was going to Catholic school, and it was the first time in my life I had sex. So I knew that God just like really, really had it out for me and was really watching me. But that's part of the ism of my disease. I wasn't drunk when that happened, but it's the way I was inside that made me have to do that. And that's the way I lived my life. Um, I uh, I had to quit going to Catholic school. I think I made it through the 10th grade. I was in the 10th grade when that happened. And this was a long time ago when it wasn't cool. And my parents made this big plan that I went back east to visit relatives. And because I made it, I was like 4 months pregnant when that semester ended, and they didn't make maternity uniforms anyway, so they weren't very liberal back in those days, in the Catholic schools especially. So my parents sent me to live with people, and to hide. They wanted to hide me because it was a bad thing. But I had that baby and gave it up for adoption, and then went back and finished school. But I didn't study. I didn't learn anything. All I cared about was if you laughed at me with me or noticed me, and whatever it took, I did it. And I have my high school annual, and I really like to look at it. Because, I mean, it would always be to Crazy Nancy, and it had to do with drinking. And I really liked that. I mean, that was my identity. I'll get my identity any way I can get it. And so, you know, I just tried to live my life in the meantime, and I drank. I look back on the way I was when I was 15 years old, and I had to climb out my window and go see this guy. Who was just he was a lot older than I was, and he was just this bum. And I just think, you know, that's my life could have just gone that way. I just could have lived my life that way. And somewhere along the line, you know, I found Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm learning to live my life a different way. And everything I know, I learn here, and I learn by watching you and seeing those in front of me, and not even those in front of me, new people. I like going places where I don't really know anybody because I don't start all that criticizing yet, you know. In my own meetings, it's like, oh, don't listen to him. He's like, you know what. You know, I try to keep an open mind, and I can learn from everybody. But so I just, you know, when I just did my life, I don't know what I did. You know, I remember in high school I cheated, and a girl next to me did my test for me, and the teacher wasn't looking, I'd hand her my test and she'd do it in a different writing. And I just went there, and I just showed up. And then after high school, I guess I thought I'd get married. I was just told I would get married and have children. That's all I was ever encouraged to do. I went to dental assisting school because I saw an ad in the paper one day. Then I became a dental assistant. I did that for a while. And while I was working in that office, I took all just pills that we had to give to nervous patients, and the pain pills and everything. And I did all the ordering in that office, and I would order a lot of these things, and I would just take them. And I always preferred alcohol. There's no doubt about that. But one of my big jobs in that office was to stand over people with that vacuum and suck the water out of their mouth. So I was like this close to the people, and I didn't ever want anybody to smell alcohol on my breath. So I took pills. I never knew why I was taking them, and I would say maybe I shouldn't take them, but I would take them anyway. Every day I would take them. And I just thought of something. The way I was then, I mean, I just thought this was an awful job, and I was very self-obsessed. And I would think of what patients were coming in that day. And I remember one time this man was coming in, and I knew that he just thought I was just nothing because he had money and he was good looking. And I mean, he didn't probably think a thing. I know that now, but it was like this. I know he's putting me down, and I'm a dental assistant here. And then I thought, what can I say to him? And what kind of conversation could I have with him? And I didn't really know too much of anything, and enough to make any sense. And so I thought, well, he has a daughter. She's been in. Maybe I could ask him how his daughter is. Then I would think, well, what if his daughter died or something since he's been here? I mean, it's just like nonstop, right, what goes on inside here. And so I just worked in that office, and I took these pills, and I worked. I came in early every day. I worked through lunch, and I worked late, and I came in on weekends and shampooed the carpets. And I just think that's what we have to do, because I was very insecure, and it's just like to keep my job. You know, and once I started doing it, it was like I had to do this. But I was also the bookkeeper, And I like took extra money for all the extra work I did. I didn't ask him if I could have the extra money. I just took it. And I figured out ways to do that. And then I learned when I got sober it was called embezzling. But I didn't, it was an awfully big word for what I was doing. I deserved it. So, and then I did get married. I got married to Joe, and we had three kids, and I made it to AA when our twin sons were 3 years old, and my other son was 1 year old. And so, you know, before that, I could drink with my brothers, and I could drink with people who drank more than I did. And I don't know that I ever really looked at it because it's kind of something I was raised with. But now I have these children, and I can't quit drinking. And I tried not to drink every day. I tried not to drink. I just remember getting up and saying, "Please, God, help me not to take a drink today." And then maybe an hour would go by, or 2 hours, or whatever. And then something would come into my mind that, you know, it's okay if you just go have one drink. That would be okay. And then I would have one drink, and then I just wouldn't stop. It didn't really dawn on me that that's what I was doing until I got here. And I was trying to raise these kids, and I wasn't doing a very good job of it. And they got hurt. I'm very lucky they came through it, but you know, one time I couldn't deal with them. I put a lock on the outside of their bedroom door because I couldn't deal with them. I didn't want them running outside. I had alcohol on my breath most of the time. Women had, in the past, gone, "Somebody's been drinking." And so I didn't want that to happen. And my kids were wild little boys, and they'd go out the door, and I'd have to get them. So I put a lock on their door. And I lived on a street that was backed up to a mountain. And I had a big bottle of wine. Somebody mentioned the different kinds of wine. I drank a lot of Spignata, Red Mountain, just because it was like $1.65 for this great big green bottle of wine. And it did what I needed it to do. So I'd go up and sit up on the mountain with my big bottle of wine, and my kids would be locked in their bedroom. And I would just cry. And just think, you know, I was young, and I thought that this, I really think that my main thought was that this was how I was going to live for the rest of my life. I know dying would have been welcomed, but it was just like, this is how it's going to be, day in and day out, till the day I die. And I was miserable, and I didn't know who to talk to or what to talk about, and I just did that until I couldn't do it anymore. And one of the boys drank charcoal lighter in the backyard, and he had to go to the hospital, and that could be very serious. And I saw one of my neighbors when I was 20 years sober. I went out there to visit, and she told me, you know, that she always watched my kids, and she knew, or she had some idea what I was doing, and we just never think that. I didn't think that. I thought I was being pretty secretive about it. But, you know, I was going into my neighbors' houses, sneaking in when they weren't home and taking their liquor and taking pills and taking money. And there's one neighbor that I had. It wasn't the one I went to visit, but this lady was so nosy, and she was always just trying to spy on me. She would be out in the cul-de-sac talking to the ladies, and I just didn't like her. So I could get my phone by my front window, and I would see her out in the middle of the street talking to these ladies, and I would dial her number, and I knew she had to go answer her phone. She could never let it ring. And I would dial her number, and she would just go tearing to her front door. And she was heavy and very top-heavy, so it was like she'd go plopping up to her door, and then she'd get to the front door, and I'd hang up. And then she would wait and wait and wait to see if that person was going to call back. Wait, 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 wait. But I'd be looking, peeking out my drapes. And then she would give up, and then she'd go back to the middle of the street, and then I would do it again. And so, you know, all in all, we're talking about the disease of alcoholism. That's not too serious. But, you know, I used to just think I was crazy. And, I mean, because that same lady, I went one day and I climbed over all the back fences to get to her house. Now, I'm like this woman living in this house, right, with my husband and my kids. And then when nobody's looking, I'm climbing over the back fences with some eggs. And she had this patio that she told us how much it cost. And she was so proud of her Palos Verdes stone patio. And so I took the eggs and I went in her backyard and I aimed them like they came over her back fence. And from the teenagers that lived behind her. And then I did hear, you know, one time when I did get caught and I had to talk to these ladies, she was telling us all how the teenagers that lived behind her ruined her Palos Verdes stone patio. And, you know, I just felt like I was like crazy. I'd go in my house and I'd go, what is wrong with you? And, but, you know, there were those things, and there were other things I did. And I, you know, my husband went in the hospital one time, and I was just like a kid, unsupervised. It's like, what can I do? And I called an old boyfriend and got together with him, and I just felt really bad. Then in the morning when I was lying to everybody, and I'd been with this man the night before, and I felt bad, and I felt bad when I would find these ugly dresses in my closet that I stole from the department store when I'd have my kids with me. It's like, why did you do that? I don't know. And, you know, I really was, you know, at a loss. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know who to talk to. In 1971, there wasn't a lot of talk about the disease of alcoholism. There weren't really a lot of treatment centers. I did see a little ad in the paper every now and then, and it said, if you're a woman with a drinking problem, call this number. I could never get the nerve to call that number. I would get the paper, and I would always open it right away to see if that little ad was in the classified section. And I guess I would just sit there and wonder what would happen if I ever called that number. I really wanted to call it, but I was afraid to. And so the day came when, you know, it was in January of 1971, we had people over to watch the Super Bowl, and I made Bloody Marys all day. And, you know, I tried to do those things, like my husband needed to, you know, have people over and entertain. I embarrassed him terribly at some of the, I had to go to business functions with him. He'd go to get the babysitter. I would say, the minute he left, I'd say, I've got to have a drink. I hated going to those parties because they were the grown-up people, and I should have been home with a babysitter, you know. And I'd have a drink, and then I'd look out the window. He's not home yet. I'd have another one. I would sometimes have 10 drinks really quick before I had to go to one of these functions. And then, you know, they gave us cocktails, and I would just do terrible things. They're the kind of things, like when you wake up in the morning, you know, and you're home, it'd be like, oh, God, I can't, please help me, that wasn't true, you know, I didn't do that. And and then I'd have to call the people and pretend I left my purse there or something, because I'd just be so, it's like I'd be so scared about the things I thought of and to see if these people were speaking to me or whatever. And, you know, maybe they weren't that awful, but I always got drunk and I always did something really stupid at their house. So we had people over this day, and I made Bloody Marys, and I drank Bloody Marys all day. And when the last man was leaving our house around 6 o'clock, I just, like, walked out the door with him. He was by himself, and I got in his car, and he drove away. And I just thought he would bring me around the block, take me back home. And we went somewhere else and had some more drinks, and I didn't normally just walk out of my house, you know, like that. And I called my husband a couple hours later, and I asked him to come get me. And he was really mad at me. And he got me. He had to get someone to watch the kids, I think, and he came and he got me. And he said, if you didn't drink so much, you wouldn't do the things that you do. You wouldn't act the way that you act. Well, I think I knew that, but he had never said that to me. And I mean, I knew he marked all the bottles in the house, and I just made new marks, and he could never find which mark was his to begin with. So he said that to me, though, and I knew it was true, and I had been trying for years not to drink. So we went in the house, and I picked up the telephone, and I called my then brother-in-law, who's a Catholic priest. He's now a Monsignor. And I was calling him because he's a priest, and I thought he could pray for me and this problem that I had. And he was living in Pennsylvania. I was living in California. And it was just really unusual that he was home, but he picked up the phone, and I was able to get it out of my mouth that I couldn't quit drinking. And he told me to go to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He had been to see what it was like so he could tell other people. And here he was telling his, his brother's wife. And it was still Sunday night, and it was my husband got on the phone and called somebody and found out where there was a meeting, and I went upstairs. You know, I really did want to quit drinking, and I wasn't reluctant at that moment. I just went upstairs and got dressed, and I was normally wearing cut-off Levi's and white T-shirts at that time, and I was very heavy, and I drank a lot of beer and wine. My face was red and blotchy. Because I was locked in my house quite a bit of the time and I was bored, I would dye my hair a lot every other day, and it was just dry and crackly and crunchy and different brassy orange yellowy colors. And I went upstairs and I put on this, I was getting dressed up now to go wherever my husband was taking me that night and to this meeting. And I put on this bright orange polyester pantsuit. And it was really tight too because I was so heavy. But I thought that I looked nice because it was nicer than I'd looked in a long time, I thought. So he got someone to watch the kids and we went off to this AA meeting. We finally found it in... it was close to 9:30, and that's what time the meeting ended out there. And a man was talking at the podium, and we came into the meeting, and we sat down. And driving there, too, I started having a second thought, and I said, like, what are these people going to do, where you're taking me? Are they going to stay with me 24 hours a day? Are they going to chain me up if they have to leave because I can't quit drinking? And then a few minutes later, I'd say, just take me home. I'll go tomorrow, okay? And he'd drive faster. And then I'd say, I'm going to jump out of the car. And then he'd drive faster. So we got to the meeting, and we went in, and we sat down. When the meeting was over, about 5 minutes later, all 30 people that were in that room that night, me, all of them. And I mean, I don't know that night if I thought that was strange. Where did all these people come from, or why did they come to me? But now I look back, and it was like I had neon lights on me, you know, with my orange face and hair and my orange polyester pantsuit, and I'd been drinking all day. And I mean, I guess it was like pretty obvious. And then, in case they didn't know already, then I just started throwing up all over the floor. So then they really knew, and they all came around me, and I did just start throwing up, and I ran outside to the parking lot, and they all came outside to the parking lot, and I found out they hadn't had a newcomer in Thousand Oaks in a long time, and they wanted to be a part of it, of this newcomer thing, and they're just out in the parking lot, and they're laughing and joking and talking, and I just, like, once I started throwing up, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't stop. I used to just break blood vessels in my eyes, you know. I always had those real ugly eyes, and they were just, this one man looked up at the sky, and he said, "We alcoholics are such lucky people. We're chosen by God." And, like, if you're even close to being new, I don't think you feel like that today, that you're chosen by God. I don't think you've gotten to that point yet. But I did. I mean, I do feel that way now. I feel it's a disease. Yes, it's a disease, but I'm glad I have it because I have a great life. And that was my beginning, though. And then two ladies came to my house. Three ladies came the next day. One was in between slips. And the other two ladies were in their 50s, and they were very old, and they didn't want to scare me away because I was very young. And so they brought this lady in her 30s, and she was in between drinking. And they just sat in my living room, these perfect strangers, and they had some little books with them, and they just sat and shared with me and told me things about themselves. Nobody that I, in my whole life up to that day, had ever talked to me like that. I don't think I ever had that feeling with these two women or three women that I had just met the night before, throwing up in the parking lot. I felt this closeness immediately. You know, I was ready. I had surrendered, I guess, before. I had suffered, you know, for several years with this disease before that night. And I was, you know, I came in here pretty willing. So that was my beginning. That was in January. Excuse me, my sobriety date is May 23rd, 1971. I did stay sober during that time. I loved it. I went to a lot of meetings, but I didn't get a sponsor simply, this is what the way I see it. I had lots of phone numbers. Lots of nice women gave me their number. And I would sit there by my phone for 2 hours staring at the phone number, thinking who that lady was. And what if I called her? Would she know who I am? And then maybe she would say, well, describe yourself. And then I'd say, fat, ugly, and orange. And then she, finally, she'd remember who I was. And then I would imagine that she would think, oh, no, it's her. I didn't really want her to call me. So I didn't want to put anybody through that. And you know, I just did not have any self-worth. So I didn't ask anybody to be my sponsor. I went to lots of meetings, and I really loved it. But I wasn't talking to anybody about anything, and we need to do that. I didn't know what you were supposed to talk to people about. I never talked about my feelings to anybody in my life. I didn't know what they were. I used to sit in speaker meetings and hear you talk, and I would write words down that you said that I didn't know what they meant, and I would try to do it so nobody would see, and then I would go home and look them up. I didn't want to ask you what they meant because you might think that I'm stupid. So I went to a meeting out in Thousand Oaks. I think the next meeting I went to after that one, and it was these women sat around the table and they read from the book As Bill Sees It, and they would pick a topic, and then they would take turns reading a page and then saying a few words, and then the next one would do the same thing. Well, all I did the whole time was just hold my book very quietly, count with my eyes how many women were in front of me. Then I would go to in the index and count which page I was going to have to read. And then I would turn the pages quietly so you wouldn't know. And then I would practice what I had to read and say the words because I didn't want you to think I didn't know how to say the words. And then I would think about what I was going to say. And it was mentioned by other speakers. It's hard getting sober. It's very difficult in the beginning. I didn't know that I used alcohol in my life to get me up to where I was. I didn't realize it at the time that I used alcohol or the ism part of my disease was, my life. I never stopped to think how scared I was. Having 5 brothers, they beat me up, I beat them up, and then I beat other people up. It's just like, you just leave and you go, I don't care, and you hit somebody, and you just act like you don't care, and you think you don't care. But I stayed sober for 4 months. I went to these meetings. I loved the meetings. And then one night my husband was late coming home with the car. I was waiting to go to my Sunday night meeting. Things had built up during that time that I didn't talk to anybody about. I think a lady had left her daughter at my house for like one. She asked me if I'd watch her daughter for the night. And I said yes, and she didn't come get her for 3 days. And then to her face, it's like, oh, it's okay, I don't mind. And inside, that wasn't what I was thinking. I could never speak up. I could never say what I meant. I could never say what was on my mind. I mean, I practically then would invite her to let her daughter live with me till she's 18 or something. But it's like when I was younger, I used to walk down the street with a can opener and scrape the paint off of people's cars because I was so mad about what you all made me do all the time. But, I learned how to be different here and to take care of myself. And so I was waiting for my husband to come home with the car, and I was thinking, he shouldn't treat an alcoholic like this. He shouldn't be late when I have to go to my meeting. I might get drunk. And then I just, really just talked myself into it. I had a bottle of wine in the refrigerator that I used to cook with, and I don't have that anymore. I don't cook with wine. I don't order things in restaurants that have wine in them, even though it's cooked out. If I have a choice, I take the choice. Why mess with it? But I don't cook with wine. And I had it in there, and it was like a big bottle, and I only needed a spoonful, but it was there. And I remember, making the decision to go drink it. Oh, a few days before that, I was at my mother's house, and I was feeling, restless, irritable, and discontent, and didn't know who to talk to and didn't have anybody to talk to. And she had some tranquilizers, and I said that I could take tranquilizers because it wasn't alcohol, and I would just do it. And I did take those pills. And so Then when I was going to drink, my mind said, well, you took those pills anyway, so why don't you just drink? And I went in, and I remember making my son stay on the couch. I didn't want them to see me do this. And I went in the kitchen, and I just picked up the bottle and drank the wine. And then my husband came home, and it's like, I said, I drank some wine. You really shouldn't be late. And I took the car and left, and I bought my big green bottle of Spinata that night, and I wanted to drink some more, and then I drank it, and I went by the meeting and looked in the window and made fun of everybody inside, and then I drank down. I drove down the freeway, and I thought, I'm just going to throw the bottle out the window, and then I can go to jail, because when I came to AA 4 months prior to that, I had a lot of things that I had done that I thought were bad, and then I heard your stories, and a lot of you did worse things, and I don't like being in the middle. I want to be the best person here or the worst person. I don't want to just be in the middle, and I just thought I should go to jail, and that would be kind of exciting, and I could come back and tell you all about that big ordeal, and so I drove down the Ventura Freeway with this big bottle of wine. I finished it all, and I tossed it out the window, and it crashed, and I just kept driving, and it's like no red lights, nothing, nobody cares, just keep driving. I went home, and I woke up in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning or something, and I was face down in my blue shag carpeting in my den one more time in my own throw-up. And that's it. I mean, that's the most of it for me. And my husband was sitting on the couch looking at me. He had gotten to a few Al-Anon meetings, and he wasn't going to do a lot, and he wasn't going to buy into my thing about it's your fault because you were late with the car. And so it was from that day. Now I'm sober, and it scared me. I came here, and when I first found Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought, I will never drink again. And I certainly don't even say that today. I don't say I will never drink again. I see people drink all the time. I've seen people in my 26 years here with 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years. I have seen it over and over and over again. There's a woman I was sponsoring in Minnesota who she's, as far as like bad things happening when you drink, she's one of the worst I've ever seen. And she has a family. She would end up in Tennessee walking down railroad tracks. And she started out in Minnesota, and she didn't know how she got there. She prostituted for alcohol. She missed going on a trip with her family because she got drunk, and so her husband took the two kids and went without her. And while they were gone, she sold all their furniture to get alcohol. And she managed to get 2 years of sobriety together, and a few months ago, she simply stopped calling me. And I hear from other people now that she was going to meetings, but now she's not. She said it's a cult, and she really doesn't want to go. And that's really scary. But I see it happen all the time. And as a matter of fact, somewhere along in my sobriety, I was in the Pacific group, and I said that this is a cult, and I've got to get out of here. And, I stayed away for about a week. And, I look back, and it's just because I had to face myself here. And I'll do anything not to do that. So if I want to think it's a cult and get out of here, luckily that didn't happen. And I've just always pretty much been here, day in and day out, doing the exact same things that I did when I first walked in the doors. I've always had a sponsor. I've had the same sponsor now for about 25 years. I call my sponsor every week. I know the number. I don't have to look it up. Because there may be that split second when I don't have time to look it up. And the gift that has been given to me here more than anything else is, as I mentioned before, is working with other people and getting to be a part of their sobriety and their growth and watching them change and then, in fact, watching them work with other people. I realized somewhere along the line that sponsoring other people for me is not for them. There isn't anything that I can tell them that you can't tell them. It's all in the book. It's all in these meetings. It's all in the fellowship. I don't have any secrets or anything that I know that's going to help somebody any more than anybody else. And the reason that, God puts all these women in my life is for me. It's for me to maintain my sobriety and to be happy, joyous, and free, which, you know, I am pretty much of the time now. I've certainly had my moments over the years like you have. And, you know, early on, I just couldn't stay in my house. At nighttime, the walls were closing in, the clock was ticking loud, I was scared. I didn't have this any kind of relationship with God at that time, and it was just scary. You know, I had like a lot of emotional dependency on my sponsor because, you know, I hadn't gotten it together with the God thing yet. And you know, there were times I drove to my sponsor's house and said, I can't do it. What's the use? I've done everything. He would say, you know, that Betty over there, that same thing happened to her, and you talked to her. And I've been, you know, life goes on. I think in the beginning I thought maybe that because we, you know, joined AA and didn't drink anymore, we were exempt from life problems. But life goes on, and just like with anybody else. And that's what we all do this together, and it's the greatest support group in the world, and we do it together, and we're there for each other. I know this was mentioned by somebody else too, but I used to hesitate to pick up the phone and call somebody. I thought that meant I was weak if I called you up and said, I really need help. And I resisted doing that for a long time. And then one day I realized it took so much strength to pick up the phone. And it was a weakness for me not to pick up the phone. I'm strong if I can call you and say, could you help me? And as long as I asked and as long as I didn't take a drink, I was never turned down. I had to have people spend the night with me sometimes because of something. I embezzled money in my sobriety. And I intended to pay it back, but it got out of hand and I got caught. And, you know, because I know my sponsor's phone number and because I learned to be open with all of you, I was able to tell people immediately, and somebody had to stay with me all night because I was scared. And then when I, you know, started relationships, so to speak, relationships. I look back and it was like I would see a guy for 10 minutes a week, maybe, at his convenience, and that was a relationship in my mind, and or an obsession, whatever. But, you know, going through all of that stuff is just, that's the worst. And I'm on my third marriage now, and, you know, my sister, I mentioned my sister before. She started in group therapy not too long after I got sober. I think she still goes to the same group therapy. She went because she had a job she hated. She still has the same job. I guess they just talk about it every week. I don't know what they do. And God, I mean, I've had like 20 jobs, and now I'm on my third husband, and it's like, go, you know, get out there and live life, you know. Don't sit in group therapy. And you know, I got divorced when I was 3 years sober. I wanted to get divorced when I was a week sober. My sponsor said, don't do anything like that in the first year. And so I was 3 years sober, and I took off with my three kids. And it was a very difficult time of my life, but it was a necessary time. I think for the next 6 years or so, I was single, learning to work, learning to be responsible, learning to pay my bills, learning to just take care of myself and my children and get to AA meetings. I tried to go to school, go to college because I thought that I should. And that was the only reason. I realized it one day. It's like, I should. I think they'll think more of me if I do, but I couldn't do take classes, work full time, go to meetings, take care of my kids. So I always just did AA. And then I got married again, and we shouldn't have gotten married. It was just one of those exciting things. It's like, who's going to win this one? And, I mean, it started before we got married, and it's just like, well, what the heck? Just, you know, he bought a ring. I felt bad because he bought a ring, and I thought, well, I might as well. And I don't want to hurt his feelings. He bought this ring. And, you know, he's a nice man, but we didn't belong together, and we just played the dance of death until one day I had to just pack my suitcases and disappear. That's when I went to Hawaii. I let the kids go live with their dad a short time before that. I never thought I would do that. That was one of my nevers. These are my kids. I'm their mother. That was a big image for me to be raising these three boys. And their dad is a very nice man. He married a very nice lady. She's an ex-nun, and she didn't have any kids that we knew of. And since she'd been in the convent most of her life, and you know, they offered to have the boys live with them, and they had a nice house and swimming pool and dogs, and he had a good job, and I was always just living in some apartment and running around and working and just. And you know, I didn't think it would ever come to pass, but I was trying by that time to get on my knees every day and say, God, I turn my life and my will over to you, and just leave it at that and stay out of the way. And I just got this overwhelming thought one day that the boys should go live with Joe and Patty. And I called my sponsor and talked to him about it, and then I went out and talked to them. And I knew in my heart it was a very good idea, that their dad loved them just as much as I did, and that they could go live with him. And I just asked God to help me do this with dignity and grace and not be full of self-pity and tell you all how hard it was for me. Just do it. And so we did that, and I'm good friends with that husband and his wife. I have a key to their house. Whenever I go to California to visit, I would just stay at their house, and we'd all sleep in the bed together. And no, no, they made me sleep at the end of it, actually, down by their feet. And but we have a good relationship. He's sober in AA. My second husband's sober in AA. My current husband is sober in AA. My kids have done, they've done okay. You know, one of them had to go to jail, and I didn't, that was just really awful when I had to sit in court one day, and I didn't think he would get a sentence because his stepmom, Patty, and I had him all dressed up in a really nice white shirt and tie, and we thought he looked really nice, and we really like him, so we thought the judge would like him too, and, so he got sentenced, and you know what? Immediately, I just said the serenity prayer, immediately, and it worked, immediately, and it was like, you just stay out of this, and just let him, whatever needs to be with him, and we made it through that, and I've had a very exciting life in Alcoholics Anonymous. Once I got out of the way, once I decided to just start walking through these fears, you know, I worked in this locked mental hospital when I was brand new. It was advised to me to go to work, and I paid this lady more money to watch my kids than I made at this job, but I needed to go to this place and work. And I used to take care of these people, and some of them were older, and they were just going to die. And I would look at them, and I would think, I wonder if they have regrets now, that and they can't go back in their life and do things that they were afraid of doing. And really, what difference does it make now? What is there to be afraid of? Who am I afraid of? And I, you know, kind of made a pact with myself at that time just to start walking through these things, that I didn't want to be sitting in a rocking chair one day looking out a window thinking of the things I didn't do because I was afraid. And I've had lots of exciting careers. Just because I showed up here and I would get to podiums like this when I didn't want to, and I talked to newcomers and when I didn't think I had anything to say to them, and did commitments in meetings, that's been my school. That's the school I never did go back, and it doesn't really matter because there's a lot inside that I've put off because of being afraid my whole life. I've got into sales for a long time. I never thought I could do that. All you hear is the word no. That's the worst word I ever want to hear. But I did that, and I made some good money, and I was able to take good care of my kids. And I was a flight attendant up until about 2 years ago. I did that for 4 years just because I heard somebody talking about it in a meeting, and I thought that sounded like a good deal, and I did that. My husband dared me to do stand-up comedy one time, and I went and did that for about 4 years. And I've had like a lot of little jobs along the way, and I decided to pursue acting. So I just, you know, I'd look in the paper in Minneapolis, and I'd see an audition, and I'd go there, and my heart would just be pounding, my stomach would be churning. It's like, what are you doing? Why are you going on this thing? And then I would just go anyway. And one of the first parts that I got there was this this woman was making an independent film, and she had me read for one part, and I got to practice that part. And then she said, well, I want you to try this other part, and I didn't get to practice for that one because she just handed it to me, and it was for this drunk woman. And so I looked at it, and then I said, okay, I'm ready. And so I did it. I just did it for her, and she just sat there, and she went, good. And so I got that part in the film. And then I was, I had to go to a meeting, and they gave us the script, and I got to see, it was just a very small part, and I had some lines, but I was, when it opened into my scene, I was supposed to be drunk, passed out, and laying in vomit on the floor. And I just got completely choked up when I read that, because I thought about it later, like, I just thought, well, I could still be living like that today. I mean, I know people that are, and you know people that are. We have people in our lives that are. But I don't have to live like that anymore. And I'm just here doing life with you. And so thank you again. Thanks for this weekend. And for inviting me here. And thanks for all of you just showing up here. Thanks.